Hi, it's Diane. Great to be back with you. On my mind this week, the March for Our Lives, the student-led protest taking place across the country this weekend. The teens are calling for safer schools and restricting access to guns. But can this reform effort succeed where others have failed? I asked two reporters from The Washington Post.
The students are essentially saying, you're the adults, you're supposed to keep us safe. Whatever that means, do it. And why haven't you? And I think that, in fact, explains why this has been so powerful, it's such a force, because the argument is very simple.
Then,
I write stories about people living with neurological diseases and disorders as a way of making these scary, overwhelming, heartbreaking subjects accessible to the general public.
Neuroscientist-turned-author Lisa Genova, best known for her novel Still Alice, about a woman's descent into Alzheimer's disease. Her latest work tells the story of a family grappling with ALS. But first, I talk with Daniel Green, a high school senior from Washington, D.C. He's one of the many students inspired to become part of the youth movement created in the wake of the Parkland shooting. Daniel, tell me about your own thinking about gun violence. Has it been an issue for you for a while since all these school shootings began happening, or has it just come alive for you?
Sure. So I was 12 years old when the Sandy Hook Elementary School shooting happened. And looking back now, it's clear to me that that's kind of when I gave up on the idea of gun control. I thought if someone could go into a school and kill 20 pre-K and kindergarten and first graders, there was nothing would be done. I didn't think anything would ever be done. But and then slowly over the past 5 or 6 years since Newtown, I guess it's just been the accumulation of so many school shootings just building up. And it's always been a frustration point for me. It's always been the thing I've been most passionate about at the dinner table. But and then seeing the courage of the Parkland survivors and their speaking and their eloquence, it's really inspired me to do as much as I can as quickly as I can.
How much have you actually had to educate yourself on gun policy? What is possible, what isn't possible?
Sure. So going through this process, I've mostly read articles. I haven't really gone into the statistics myself, but I've read articles from a bunch of different sources. And so my personal opinion is pretty strong. I think there should be no semi-automatic weapons or automatic weapons in the hands of civilians at all. I know that I am in the vast minority on that. But I think that to start, the things that have been advocated for years, that 90%+ of the population support, that a ban on bump stocks, a ban on assault weapons, a ban on high-capacity magazines, universal background checks, I think those are really the first steps. But I think in order to really join the rest of the advanced and civilized world, we need to have even stricter restrictions than that.
And do you think that's really possible?
Long term, I do. I think what we've done here is I've described it to my friends almost as a good start, because we're raising attention on the issue. We're making sure people know how we feel. But I think soon we will see some action on assault weapons.
Daniel, how do you feel? I mean, what's happened to you inside as you've seen these kinds of school shootings?
What distressed me the most was that after Parkland, I barely noticed the CNN notification. I looked at it, I saw that there was yet another school shooting, and I kind of registered that it was bigger this time, but I moved on. And then looking back, that's when I realized, oh my God, 17 people were brutally murdered. And so the fact that we are at a place where the murder of 17 teachers and students and educators is something that it can pass by almost in a lot of people's minds, that's a place we cannot be in. And I think this accumulation of so many mass shootings, so many tragedies has really put us in a terrible place as a country. But I do think that we have finally found the courage to fight back. And I think that's really important.
Of course, the question becomes, why teenagers like yourself, mm-hmm. why some feel so strongly about these issues and others are simply, as you were earlier, mm-hmm. having it sort of pass by.
So I think people my age generally fall into three different categories. There are people like who are where I am now, where we have decided enough is enough, and that's the rallying cry that we've used for the past few months. But enough is enough, that it is finally time to do something about this. There are people who have become numb to the issue, like I was a few months ago, where it's just another problem in this country where we have so many dividing issues right now. And then there are people who I don't know. There are people who live in places that aren't like D.C., where gun culture is part of their daily lives. And I cannot relate to that, so I can't speak to why they're not acting in favor of gun control. But I do think that for this issue to progress further, we need to find a way to bring in teenagers from those communities. Because in order to have a truly united front, we do need those kinds of people.
And what's it going to take to get them involved?
Honestly, I don't know. It might require people to start knowing people who have been affected, because although it is a widespread problem, most people don't know someone who was involved in a school shooting.
You have
I
not
don't.
Known.
No one I know personally does. But I think as people my age disperse into the world and meet new people and hear new opinions, I hope and I pray that they will see our side of things, that people's right to own a firearm and to shoot in their backyard does not justify the lives of countless teenagers and children.
Daniel, thank you so
thank
much
you.
For coming in to talk with us.
Thank you.
And now for a broader look at these protests and what school violence in America really looks like, I talked with Wesley Lowery and John Woodward Cox, both reporters with The Washington Post. John, I'm going to start with you. I know you've just finished a year-long analysis of every school shooting since Columbine. Tell us how many there have been and how many people have actually been affected?
Sure. So we used a very narrow definition of school shootings. We really only looked at shootings that happened during school hours at primary and secondary schools. We excluded a lot of things. But with our analysis, what we found is there had been 193 schools that had had a shooting. And within those schools, there were more than 187,000 students present when those shootings occurred.
So that means a fairly small percentage of the total population has actually been affected.
So it does make up a small percentage of the gun violence epidemic. You know, there's 24 kids in this country who are shot every day. So this does make up a small percentage. But the difference is in a school, even if someone is only injured or if no one is injured, you could be talking about 1,500 kids. And what we've seen now is it's changing the way that kids grow up. This week I've heard so many stories from parents whose kids are terrified by active shooter drills. We had a kid in the story who wrote a will. He actually was a sixth grader who his school went into lockdown. He had heard about Parkland, and he and his friend wrote wills saying, if I die in my school, this is what I want to leave behind.
Oh, my goodness.
This very morning, you know, I had posted my story on Facebook, and a woman said that her six-year-old was having nightmares, and she couldn't sleep at night. And this is not a kid who had been through a school shooting, but she's imagining, what do I do if there's someone with a gun in my school? So I think a lot of us grew up in schools that we felt this was a safe haven, and that is changing. That is changing.
Tell us who the victims actually are.
So while a lot of the calls for reform and a lot of the media attention is paid to students who at mostly white schools, what we have found is that black students are three times more likely to experience a school shooting than a white student, and Hispanic students are twice as likely. And those cases often don't get as much attention. That's partly because Those shootings tend to be more targeted. There are fewer people injured. So schools like Sandy Hook and Parkland and Columbine, those were indiscriminate shootings. Those are scarier. But that doesn't mean a shooting in Birmingham or Atlanta or Chicago or Philadelphia in which one person is shot aren't just as traumatizing for the kids who are in those schools.
So what you're saying, I gather, is that many, if not most, of these school shootings happen in minority schools.
Right, yes. Over 60% of the students in these schools were children of color.
And who did the shootings?
So what we found, the median age was 16 years old. The shooters tended to reflect the race of the school. So white shooters shot schools that were mostly white. Black shooters, schools that were mostly black. We found really consistently that that was the case. 7 in 10 of the shooters are under the, or were under the age of 18. And almost always male, 17 to 1, male to female. There have been female shooters, but it's very rare. And the vast majority of these people show no signs of mental illness.
No signs of mental illness. I want to get back to that in just a moment. But Wesley, I want to turn to you because after Parkland, certainly there seems to have developed this very strong movement on the part of these young people. Tell me how these kids were able to organize the protest that's coming up on Saturday and do it so effectively.
Of course. You know, I think it's been striking to watch how quickly this kind of movement has caramelized, right? That what we saw was almost immediately within the first 24 hours, students who had been present for the shooting in Parkland began through media interviews, essentially, transitioning not just from witnesses of violence or mourners of the victims, but rather into kind of an activist role where they were speaking out. It's not particularly surprising to me. You know, sometimes there's a different level of candor when you're a teenager. You're willing to stand in front of a camera and say exactly what you're thinking. You're not necessarily calculating the same way. And very quickly, many of these young people, from David Hodge to Emma Gonzalez to Alex Wind, went viral. Their interviews were being seen everywhere, prompting additional interviews. The kind of existing gun control advocacy groups began reaching out to them. Some other youth activism groups began reaching out to them. They start working with some folks from the Women's March. And very quickly, what had been just a group of half a dozen teenagers initially swelled into about 2 or 3 dozen teenagers who went to Tallahassee and began petitioning the state government for gun control measures. And then, you know, within a week or two, had announced this march that's now coming up in Washington. And so, and we've seen walkouts in schools across the country. And we're going to see not just a march in Washington this weekend, but marches also in different cities around the country.
So what is it they're saying they want?
There is this tug of war right now about what this policy conversation will be. There are folks who say this should be a conversation about school safety, about school security guards, about reinforced windows and doors and protocols. And then there's, you know, probably the majority of folks involved in this conversation who think the conversation in some capacity should be around guns. And the students certainly are advocating that. What they were pushing for in Florida as well as nationally were additional measures on high-capacity magazines, on the availability of so-called assault rifles. And so I think that, that mental health background checks and universal background checks broadly. And so there's this question of this wish list that folks for a long time have been advocating. Will this provide enough momentum for any of those things to be checked off the list? But beyond that, there is some simplicity in the argument coming from the students. The students are essentially saying, you're the adults, you're supposed to keep us safe. Whatever that means, do it. And why haven't you? And I think that, in fact, explains why this has been so powerful. It's such a force, because the argument is very simple. Teenagers are looking to society, to adults, and saying, hey, why aren't we safe in our schools? Why haven't you fixed this?
And the title of the march, March for Our Lives, seems so powerful and so dramatically aimed at those who are in power, Wesley.
Mm-hmm. Well, exactly. And I think that The personal element here, I think, is very powerful, right? You're talking about students who were in these classrooms. You're talking about students who could be in the next classroom. And I think that that personalizes this in a way that's more powerful than the family members of a victim necessarily, right? And I remember doing an interview with Alex Wind, one of the young people from Parkland who's one of the student organizers. And I remember talking to him and him saying, well, look, people want me to go back next week to the same school where my friends got murdered in the hallway last week. And nothing has been changed. The hallway is no more safe than it was last week. And so what am I supposed to do? How am I supposed to go back and feel safe? No matter what your views politically, that's a powerful argument to hear from a young person. And so I think that, again, the way this has been personalized, the way that the young people themselves have taken this on, I think John and our colleague Stephen Rich have done remarkable work in quantifying the depths and this generation of students who have lived through these experiences. I mean, I remember even being in high school and having a lockdown drill and my social studies teacher crying in the corner. I'll never forget what that was like in this moment to feel as if we were not safe inside of a school.
Whoa.
Students even younger than I am. Right, who now are living this every day. And
exactly.
It's really changed a generation of American voters.
Here is the question, as you heard John say, minority students, low-income students, these are the kids who are apparently most impacted by gun violence. Are they equally represented in these protests?
Well, and I think that the attention unquestionably has been unequal in terms of whose stories we're paying attention to, in terms of which of these shootings get the most attention. Now, as John noted, in these kind of indiscriminate shootings that tend to kill, you know, maybe a dozen people or wound a dozen people, those draw the headlines and draw our attention. But we know that the story of gun violence in America is not a story of that type of indiscriminate mass shooting. Rather, it's a story of more routine gun violence that happens every single day. And unfortunately, I think those stories don't get told the same way or with the same fervency and aren't necessarily represented in these kind of big mass events. There are violence marches and conversations happening in cities across the country all the time. We just may not be paying attention to them. Hmm. What the Parkland students have done, which I think is interesting, or at least is at the very least self-aware, is several of them have taken trips. I know Emma Gonzalez, for example, last week was in Chicago meeting with young black and brown gun violence activists there and having a conversation about how perhaps she can use her platform to further advance what their needs are, because they are more representative of what gun violence looks like. And so there is a conversation about, you know, this is clearly, I mean, this is a more suburban, white, affluent district that's receiving a lot of attention, a lot of resource. What does it look like in a world where perhaps we're more equitable with who we're paying attention to?
John, from the research you've done, what do you hear that the federal government may be offering? What are they pinpointing?
Well, not a lot. You know, really, I think one of the key issues in this entire debate, and it's often overlooked, is the fact that the CDC has not studied gun violence in this country for 22 years.
And that's because?
That's because the Republican-led Congress in 1996 put in what's called the Dickey Amendment, where they said that no CDC funds can be used to promote gun control, essentially. And that ended essentially all gun research in this country. Even the private research, the money dried up. And that, so right now, in fact, there is clarifying language in this bill that is on the verge of being passed. Now, whether they're actually going to fund research or not is unclear. But if anything is going to change this issue, and it's that. Period, that it requires research to come up with real solutions. Right now, when people say arm teachers, that's the solution, or ban assault rifles, that's the solution, they're basing that on virtually no information, or at least anecdotal information. The only way to know what could make a difference is if the CDC or some other major entity does the research. That's what this will require.
Do we have any idea how effective it could be from past experience to either arm teachers or to have armed security guards around?
So our research shows that there have been in excess of 65 shootings at schools in which there was a resource officer present. They almost can never do anything to intervene because these shootings tend to end within a few seconds. Someone is coming there to shoot one other person or two other people, and then it's over. We have only seen since 1999, there's only been one case in which a resource officer actually gunned down an active shooter, and that was in 2001. There was a case just this week in which we don't know whether the gunman took his own life or whether that officer shot him. But that would just be the second in two decades. So this idea that, you know, arming people in these schools will stop these shootings, we know demonstrably that's not true.
The administration and members of Congress keep pointing to mental health issues rather than guns. Is that simply a way to avoid the gun issue?
You know, it seems to be. Certainly critics would say that it is, that it's a diversion. And what we have seen, certainly in our research, the vast majority, overwhelming majority of these gunmen showed no signs of debilitating mental illness like schizophrenia.
No signs.
None. Now, certainly in Parkland, it appeared that he did have mental health issues and that people were alerting authorities to that. There have been some. But if we're talking about the numbers, these 190-plus shooters, the vast majority of those shooters did not show any signs of debilitating mental illness.
So the question becomes, Wesley, public opinion polls have changed since Parkland, since this congestion of mass shootings. Is that going to make any difference?
I think it could. I mean, I do think while, journalistically, I tend to be a cynic, in part because, you always want to wait and see what happens and stay out of the prediction game. I do think that we've already seen some tangible movement in spaces that you might not already. Republican governor in Florida has signed, new legislation into law that begins to restrict access to some type of weapons. That's something that would have been never would have predicted 6 months ago necessarily. We have seen we see a Democrat from Alabama on the Senate floor yesterday calling for a new conversation about gun control. Every part of that sentence is something we couldn't have predicted a year ago. A Democratic senator from Alabama calling for gun control from the Senate floor, and so there is. I think sometimes there's this kind of tendency towards fatalism as it relates to big structural changes to our society. There's this belief that, of course, we'll never do anything about guns. But I do think that as public opinion changes and as it changes sharply, that could, in fact, change the contours of our politics, which means we could end up seeing things we wouldn't have expected otherwise.
But, of course, the phrase gun control is all in the mind of the thinker. So the question about assault weapons comes up. Is there, John, in your view, any possible chance of making a difference, a change on the availability of assault rifles?
I don't think in the immediate future. But one thing that we have seen is the retailers, the sellers of these guns, that might be the quicker way, I think, for reform advocates to move the dial is to go to the places that care about bottom lines. And, you know, Dick's Sporting Goods, for example. Now, which guns they're going to take off or how they're going to define that, we don't know yet. But, you know, that was a real risk for them because that angered certainly a lot of their customers. But they felt that was the right thing to do. As Wes talked about, you know, these decisions that are being made in Florida are, they feel incremental, but they're significant. The background checks, that was significant. You know, that Dylan Roof, for example, he got his gun because of a failure in our background check system that Florida has now closed that loophole. So I think all of these things, we're seeing incremental changes, but, you know, that's part of what's happening here in D.C. We have 500,000 people showing up here, and I think places like Dick's Sporting Goods and Walmart, these sellers of these weapons, pay attention to that. That's not to say, though, that if someone was really motivated to get one of these guns that they couldn't. There are in excess of 250 million guns in this country. A lot of those are high-powered rifles, assault rifles, however sort of what term we want to use, rifles that are being used in these shootings. And if somebody's really motivated, it's going to be hard to prevent them from getting one of those weapons.
Wesley, what's your thinking?
I'd echo a lot of what John said. I mean, I think that we do. We live in a society, we live in a country where we have access to weapons. And we often, in the light of these shootings, begin to do this investigation, we being in society, we being journalists, and we try to figure out, well, if only the system had worked a little bit differently, if only there was a school resource officer, if only the mental health checks had worked. And that is often true to some capacity, right? That certainly seems to be true in Parkland, that there were clear warning signs. But we do live in a society where we can walk into a Walmart, basically anyone can walk into a Walmart and walk out with weapons that have the capacity to kill a lot of people. And as long as that is true, and that is true, we live with this kind of threat to ourselves when we're going out in public. You know, I spent a lot of time covering the Las Vegas shooting last year, and Stephen Paddock, who commits, you know, the deadliest mass shooting in at least our modern history, our recent history, had shown no signs that this was going to happen, right? And so it seems almost impossible that that's the type of thing that could have been stopped. As long as someone like him has access, and someone like him meaning just an American, has access to this type of weaponry, it's very difficult to figure out how you could have stopped a shooting like Las Vegas.
Everyone wants to know, is this time different, John?
In some ways, this feels a little bit different to me. To Wes's earlier point, we're skeptics, and we have to be. But there are parts of this that do feel different. And I think it's, pardon the cliche, but there is a little bit of a perfect storm here, that these kids were of an age where they understood the world. They knew who they were. They felt entitled enough that we deserve to be safe in our schools. They're incredibly articulate, but they're still kids. They're not 19. They're not 20. They're still 16, 17 years old. And so, you know, it's going to take something beyond this weekend, though, for there to be real change. This can't be the period on the sentence if they want there to be change. This has to be weeks and months. I think what will be more telling is the next time there's a significant school shooting, do those kids in that school react the same way? Is this now the way that children all over America, that teenagers all over America are going to react every time a gun goes off in their school? So I think that would be hard to stop that momentum if that's what's going to happen. But, you know, these kids in Parkland, a lot of them, the trauma that they are going to feel, it hasn't hit them yet. So whether they can sustain this for months and months and months, when eventually it hits them, I was there that day and I have to deal with that, you know, that's going to be more complicated.
Wesley, is this time different?
It feels different. And you know what? And I think we can say thus far it has been different. We have seen change. Although even when we say that, I think sometimes we have a tendency even to erase or to not remember some of the changes that have happened. I mean, one of the kind of turns of phrases or conventional wisdom is that nothing changed after Sandy Hook. And while there certainly wasn't big omnibus federal legislation, states like Connecticut, where Sandy Hook happened, did pass significant legislation to try to curb gun violence. And places like Connecticut have, in fact, seen the fruits of that labor. And so I do think that, you know, we expect sometimes a big silver bullet. One day, one bill will pass, and all of a sudden everything will change. But we live in a much more iterative society than that. And so is this different in that? Is this the time when everything happens and everything changes? You know, like I said, I remain kind of a skeptic of that. But is this... Does this momentum build, and does it continue to build over time? Certainly. And is it building now? I think unquestionably.
Wesley, John, thank you so very much for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Now a quick break.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
It's news,
culture, and curiosities.
From the District, Tacoma Park,
Alexandria,
Friendship Heights,
Hyattsville,
Falls Church,
Northeast Washington, D.C., in your inbox every weekday afternoon.
DCS Daily.
Sign up at dcs.com/newsletter.
dcis.com/newsletter.
And we're back. About a decade ago, Lisa Genova self-published the book Still Alice, about a woman's struggle with early onset Alzheimer's. It went on to become a bestseller and an Academy Award-winning film. Since then, she's written four other books, all exploring a different neurological disease or disorder. Her latest is titled Every Note Played, and tells the story of a man recently diagnosed with ALS.
Lisa Genova, I am so pleased to talk with you.
Oh, thank you, Diane. I'm so happy to be talking with you as well.
Well, I'll tell you, this book of yours has just really touched my heart. Tell me why you chose to concentrate on ALS.
This is now my fifth book, so I write stories about people living with neurological diseases and disorders as a way of making these scary, overwhelming, heartbreaking subjects accessible to the general public. I think most folks aren't going to read the Journal of Neuroscience to learn about Alzheimer's or ALS, but they might read a novel. And so why ALS? It was because of Richard Glatzer. He was the co-director of the film Still Alice, and he was diagnosed with ALS just 2 months before he read my book. By the time I met Richard, he had bulbar ALS, so his symptoms began in his neck and head, and so his first symptoms involved losing his voice. So I never heard the sound of Richard's voice, and by the time he was on set, he had one arm paralyzed and was typing his direction on an iPad with one finger. So shortly after the Still Alice premiered, I asked him if I could write about ALS next in his honor, and would he help me understand what it feels like to live with it. So Richard Glatzer was the first person I ever knew well with ALS.
But then you went on to be with other people who had ALS and to reproduce their symptoms in literary form in such a way that made the disease come alive.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, that's the idea and the goal with the stories, is to tell the truth under the imagined circumstances. And so how can I do that? I do a lot of homework. And so in addition to reading everything I can about the clinical management of the disease and maybe memoirs and nonfiction books about ALS, scientific research papers, I then go out into the community. And so I shadowed neurologists and nurses at the ALS clinic at Mass General, and I went and visited people who have ALS in their homes with Ron Hoffman, who runs Compassionate Care ALS. So I got to know 12 people living with ALS, and actually 8 of those 12 died before I finished writing the final draft. So it's this disease, I got very close with a lot of people and saw all of what can unfold with this disease.
I must say, I think it must have been quite heroic on their part to have you become so close to them as they deteriorated from their disease.
Yeah, it's really humbling, Diane. And it also really instills a sense of urgency and responsibility in me that these people who don't have much time left, several of the people I met died 15 months after their diagnosis. So they've got limited minutes left on this earth, and that they allow us, at first a stranger, we become close friends in quick time, but that they allow me in and share their most vulnerable selves with me at the most vulnerable moments of their lives. I really don't take that lightly. And I'm so grateful to all of these people who so generously shared the intimate details of their lives and deaths with me.
Many people know ALS as Lou Gehrig's disease. Many people who are afflicted with ALS are quite young, as is the central character of your book, whose name is also Richard. Tell us about him.
Yeah, so most people diagnosed with ALS are between the ages of 40 and 70. So the main character in my book, Richard Evans, is 45 years old, and he's a concert pianist. 80% of people who have ALS have their first symptoms in their hands or their feet. And those symptoms involve weakness, twitching, or cramps. And so for most people, it's the dominant hand, and it's a weakness. So you suddenly have trouble working the keys in your front door, or you're having trouble with your zipper or a can opener, or you're dropping your tennis racket, or you're dropping your phone. And people at first think that maybe this is tendonitis or a pinched nerve, and it doesn't stay in that hand or foot. It starts to move. And that's how we know that, that's an indication we're probably looking at a progressive neurodegenerative disease like ALS. So with Richard, I made him a concert pianist because I wanted the loss of the strength and agility in his hands to really be a threat to his identity. So with all of my books, I'm looking for, in addition to the diseases, what are the universal human experiences that we can all relate to? So what if this character can no longer be what he's put all of his worth and identity in? Who is he then? And how can he still matter? And with a disease where there's no cure, where can we find moments of healing and growth?
And, of course, Richard is divorced from his wife.
Yes. And so this disease becomes an opportunity for these two people who have so much unresolved between them and haven't communicated well together. And there's a lot of pain in their history. There's an opportunity because Richard can no longer live on his own and has no one to care for him. His ex-wife reluctantly offers to be his full-time caregiver. So now these two are under the same roof in the same room, and ALS becomes the vehicle for this possibility for them. And so we've got this disease, ALS, that progressively paralyzes a person. So eventually you can't walk, you can't feed yourself, toilet yourself, you eventually can't speak and breathe. It's terrifying to think of becoming totally paralyzed and trapped in your body. And yet, how many of us without ALS are paralyzed in some way in our lives where we don't allow ourselves to live the dream we really want, to have the life we really want to have? We have excuses and blame and fear. So there's some of that going on with these two characters. There's also the idea of communication. If you have ALS, you eventually lose the ability to speak. The thought of that is the worst for most people when they can no longer connect and say what they need to say to the people they love. Well, how many of us who don't have ALS, who are perfectly capable of saying anything we want, say what needs to be said to the people in our lives? Do we apologize? Do we forgive? Do we say, I love you? So these characters have this interesting urgency and opportunity to maybe resolve some things and find forgiveness and redemption.
And, of course, there is Richard's daughter, Grace.
Yeah, Grace is a college student, and she's young and I think a bit self-absorbed like most kids that age, and thinks sort of very black and white, as I think people do when they're younger. And she's villainized her dad. Someone has to be right and someone has to be wrong in the marriage and divorce. And she's made her dad wrong. And now he's come back home and she's judging her mom and judging her dad and trying to wrestle with seeing ALS, this disease, which is fatal, in her father, in the house she grew up in. It's a really hard thing for people to see. You know, I think millions of us are familiar with the three letters ALS. We've dumped buckets of ice water over our heads. And so we have a conscious awareness that ALS exists, but most of us haven't seen it up close. We haven't felt what it feels like to be in the same room with this disease. That's one of the things I hope this book accomplishes.
Lisa, would you be good enough to read for us from page 84, where Richard is thinking about what he's lost and what he still has to lose? I think it really paints a picture of the wrenching nature of ALS, starting with the introduction of each new medicine.
The introduction of each new medicine, adaptive device, specialist, and piece of equipment comes with a corresponding loss of function and independence. The new medications for drooling and depression, the new voice-to-text phone app, the ankle-foot orthotic he's supposed to wear to keep his right foot from dropping, the feeding tube he'll soon need, the power wheelchair waiting for him in the living room, the BiPAP already ordered. Each one is his signature on the dotted line of a contract agreeing to the next phase of ALS. He's standing in a lake of dense quicksand, and every offer of assistance is a block of concrete placed atop his head, sinking him irrevocably deeper. And although Richard can't bear to talk about it, he's keenly aware of the last concrete block in the queue. When his diaphragm and abdominal muscles quit their jobs entirely, and he can't produce any respiratory pressure on his own, the final offering from his multidisciplinary medical team will be mechanical ventilation through a tracheostomy tube, 24/7 life support. Up to his eyeballs in quicksand, he'll be asked to blink once if he wants to live.
Oh my, what a story. It must have been difficult for you to write this.
Yeah, this was none of my books are romantic comedies, so I am used to living in the trenches with people who are dealing with some pretty heavy stuff. But yeah, this book was more intense for me, more emotional. I think in some ways because, you know, with Alzheimer's or Huntington's, while those are fatal neurodegenerative diseases, it stretched out a bit longer. So you have 10 to 20 years of living before you reach end stage. And with ALS, at least with the folks I saw, you know, again, the average life expectancy is 3 years. And so I lost a lot of friends in the course of writing this book. And so the emotions were heightened and intense and really personal.
And I must say, I would think that it takes a lot out of you to do these kinds of books, considering that you are so close to your subjects.
Yeah. And I mean, the idea really is to be emotionally permeable and not to build any walls, to allow whatever's happening and whatever we're all feeling to penetrate me so that I can allow that to get on the page. You know, while that's hard in some ways, it also feels like such a privilege to witness, you know, someone offering who they are and that sort of naked vulnerability while they're still here. So, and the families I came to know, this disease really does involve a family and a community and a village to take care of someone with ALS is a monumental endeavor. And so I got to know a lot of beautiful, heroic, amazing human beings. You know, I think the media tends to portray this disease by sort of the heroic figures who choose to go on the tracheostomy tube and 24/7 life support. So we know about Stephen Hawking, who passed away last week, and we know about Steve Gleason or Pete Frates. And we see people who, quote unquote, beat ALS and keep going through life support. And yet I think there are these other heroes of the disease that the media doesn't pay attention to because maybe it's not as flashy. But I was witness to the heroes who choose not to continue and not to go on life support when the time comes and to say goodbye to everyone. And I witnessed such grace in that. And so while it's sad and it's difficult to watch, it's also it's just very human. And these people who faced their mortality and their death with such courage and love and grace, it really was inspiring in many ways.
Are you talking there about the decision to choose medical aid in dying?
Well, in some ways, yes. Yeah. So with ALS, there comes a time where you're becoming increasingly paralyzed. All of your voluntary muscles will eventually become unavailable to you. The motor neurons that feed those muscles are dying off. And so eventually the muscles of your diaphragm, which controls your lung, your breathing, and the abdominal muscles surrounding your lungs also give out, and you won't be able to breathe. And so at this point, the choice, the fork in the road, is you get a surgery where they place a tube down your trachea and you're connected to a ventilator, mechanical ventilation, and 24/7 ICU level care for the rest of your life. Or you choose not to do that, knowing that you won't be able to support breathing on your own. You'll have not enough oxygen or too much carbon dioxide because you can't exhale enough of that out. And so you'll eventually suffocate. And so to do that in a way that's not panicked or painful, hospice is brought in or palliative care is brought in, this is done under supervision. And so people are sedated and given morphine, and it can be and should be a peaceful letting go.
You have talked about what people can do to prevent Alzheimer's. You wrote about in Still Atlas. Tell me what you believe people can do.
Age is the number one risk factor for Alzheimer's, and there is sort of this sense that there's no cure for the disease, there's no treatment that stops the disease, there's nothing we can do. And yet, there are things we can do. We need to start thinking about brain health like we do heart health. And so if you're like Alice and Still Alice, you've inherited a really rare genetic mutation that causes Alzheimer's no matter what you do. But only 5% of folks with Alzheimer's actually have that genetic dominantly inherited form of the disease. 95% of folks have their genetic predispositions, whatever they've inherited from mom or dad and can't do anything about, that tip their scale a little bit one way or the other, whether they're more prone to Alzheimer's or more resistant toward it. But the rest has to do with how we live. And we're just uncovering a lot of interesting data and longitudinal studies and information that shows sort of some common sense stuff. So we know that exercise decreases your risk of developing dementia by a third. Those studies were done in the past couple of years. And
now, explain, if you can, why that should be.
So in animal studies, we've seen in mice that aerobic exercise clears away something called amyloid beta. Amyloid beta is the protein that starts to accumulate. This is sort of like the first that we know of biopathophysiology of the disease. So this protein starts to build up in the synapses, which are the spaces between neurons where they connect and communicate. And as it starts to build up, it binds to itself, forming plaques. So some of you may have heard of amyloid plaques. And as the plaques start to build and build, eventually they trigger a cascade of molecular events that cause sort of the next phases of the pathophysiology of the disease. So they cause neurofibrillary tangles and inflammation and cell death. But prior to the plaques reaching that sort of tipping point, you don't have any symptoms yet. You're still sort of in this little safe zone. And we think it takes 10 to 20 years of amyloid plaque accumulation before you have your first clinical symptom, outward symptom of Alzheimer's. So you're not having symptoms of memory, language, and cognition problems yet. So while we're increasing amyloid beta, is there something we can do to knock that down, to stop that accumulation or lessen the accumulation, sweep it away? It turns out exercise, for reasons we don't entirely understand, exercise helps clear it away. So we also know a Mediterranean diet helps decreasing your risk of Alzheimer's. We know things like people who have diabetes, hypertension, high cholesterol, people who smoke all have an increased risk of Alzheimer's. And autopsy studies have shown that as many as 80% of people with cardiovascular disease also had Alzheimer's disease. So they seem to go hand in hand in some ways. Sleep is a big one. So how many of us probably don't get enough sleep? I know I'm in that category. It turns out there's a lot of new studies about sleep and Alzheimer's. So it turns out that in our slow-wave deep sleep, our glial cells in our brains, those are like the janitor cells in our brains. They sweep away metabolic waste that accumulated in our synapses while we were in the business of being awake. And which is great because one of the things that accumulates or can accumulate is amyloid beta. Well, what happens if you deprive yourself of sleep and don't get enough of that slow wave deep sleep? Well, the glial cells don't have enough time to do what they were supposed to do, and they don't get the job done. So you wake up in the morning with, junk on the floor. And so you have already accumulated amyloid beta when you start the day. So over time, we know that this can lead to reaching that tipping point. So we know that we can do things like exercise, eat better, and sleep. Just really low-tech basic things can really help tip the scale and prevent the onset of Alzheimer's.
Lisa, we talked earlier about medical aid in dying in regard to ALS. We know that medical aid in dying is now available in six states plus the District of Columbia. I wonder what your thoughts are on medical aid in dying when an individual perhaps believes that Alzheimer's is inevitable.
You know, it's interesting. When I was doing the research for Still Alice, I was in touch daily with anywhere from a dozen to 27 people who are living with early stage or early onset Alzheimer's. And at least once a year, the group, we were on a Yahoo email group in addition to online chats and individual conversations. But the group would get into a discussion about the right to end your own life when faced with this disease. And the folks were pretty split. There were those who believed that they should be able to do it and those that didn't. And in the end, everybody usually ended up agreeing to disagree. Yet what I found extraordinary about this conversation every time it came up was that these were folks in their 40s, 50s, and early 60s, all contemplating whether or not they should end their life. And that's where this disease forces the conversation to go, whether you think that's what you want to do or not. So I actually had my character wrestle with that as well. And at least for me in the book, and where I had Alice go was, you know, Alice, before she had Alzheimer's, thought that, well, you know, if I can't remember my address or my daughter's name, then I don't want to be here anymore. I don't see any value in me being here if I can't be a professor and know the people in my life by their name or know my biography. And so she planned her own exit by the time that would happen. And for many reasons, she missed her own exit strategy. And I think that Alice before Alzheimer's didn't know what she didn't know. And so at least for her, she didn't understand that she was worth more than what she could remember, that even if she couldn't remember her street address, that she could still love the people in the room with her. Even if she didn't know who they were, she could still feel love and want to be there that day. And so while this is what I chose for my character, I also recognize that these issues aren't black and white. And I try to form no judgments in those areas when I write these stories. I think that if someone has chosen to want to go, then they should, you know, have the medical assistance they need for that. You know, when doing the research for Huntington's disease, the sort of other issue there is, you know, do you want to find out whether you're going to get Huntington's? You can have genetic testing. There's only one thing that causes Huntington's, and it's a genetic mutation, and you can get a blood test to find out if you're going to get it. So would you want to know? And I thought this was a black and white question, an easy yes or no, and I would think yes. But over and over again, I was struck by, you know, people's lives are unique and circumstances are different for even the same person, depending on whether it's this year, next year, or in 5 years. So I think that having options available and possibilities for people to have control over their own lives and their own outcome are a good thing.
And where are you personally on that issue of medical aid in dying for yourself?
Oh, gosh. Well, with respect to ALS, if it were me, I wouldn't go on the life support. I would choose to let go and die at that point. And that's just me. You know, I think that every family has their own decisions to make. So I would have hospice come in and help me go peacefully surrounded by family. And that's, you know, I've witnessed that and I've seen how that can go. Only 7% of people with ALS choose what Stephen Hawking and folks like Pete Frates and Steve Gleason and Augie have done. I don't have the stats on this, but I think it tends to be more men than women. There are different reasons to stick around. So, like, the choice to continue living or dying, it's, you know, I think one of the reasons Stephen Hawking lived so long with ALS is he found great meaning in living, right? So he's a theoretical physicist who can live in the realm of his mind.
And we should
he didn't need his body. Yeah.
We should point out here that with ALS, the mind continues to function.
For most, so for 75% of folks, your mind is completely intact, lucid, intellect, curiosity, personality, all intact. But for 25% or so, they do develop frontotemporal lobe dementia. So to add cruelty upon cruelty, there is that can happen. And most folks don't talk about that. So fortunately for Stephen Hawking, he caught a break there so that he could, you know, find great purpose in continuing to live, because he could miraculously, brilliantly, you know, do mathematical equations in his head and contribute to theoretical physics. For other folks, it may not be that, you know, as sort of worldly, globally sort of important, but, you know, maybe I want to stick around to see my daughter get married, or maybe I want a few more months for one last Christmas with my family.
Sure.
Everybody has different reasons for staying and for going, and I think honoring those is where I'm at.
And what about should you be confronted with Alzheimer's personally?
Well, personally, you know, it's funny. When my grandmother had this, I really didn't know how to be with her and her Alzheimer's. I was 28 when she was diagnosed and was really heartbroken and unnerved and very black and white. Again, I was young. And I didn't know then what I understand now. And knowing I know so many people living with Alzheimer's, and that's really something I hope all of my books do, but especially with Still Alice, my first book, it was, you know, I think the public's perception of Alzheimer's goes immediately to end stage and fear. So they think, oh my gosh, Alzheimer's is, I picture someone in a nursing home, she doesn't know anyone anymore, she doesn't have any memories, she's in the fetal position most of the day. Like, who wants that? And so you think, you equate Alzheimer's with death and fear. But what does it look like and feel like to live with Alzheimer's? You've skipped, you know, all that leads up to death. So we all die. But what does living with Alzheimer's look like? And I know so many people living with Alzheimer's, and their lives still matter. And I love my relationships with those folks, and I'm so glad they're still here. So for me, the idea of if I'm diagnosed with Alzheimer's someday, and I'm 47 now, and I really believe we're going to see preventative medicine for Alzheimer's before I'm 75 for sure. My grandmother was diagnosed in her 80s. I believe she probably was symptomatic in her 70s. So in my family, that might be around the time where I might expect to be symptomatic if I'm following in those footsteps. I'm not as afraid of it, because you know what I think, Diane? I think as human beings, we're afraid of what we're not familiar with. And that makes us really uncomfortable and really scared if we don't understand something. Because I'm so familiar with Alzheimer's and people who live with it and the humanity behind the clinical and the scientific of the disease, I don't fear it.
Lisa Genova, you are not only a fine writer, you are a very inspiring speaker. Thank you so much for joining me.
Oh, Diane, thank you so much. It was such a pleasure talking with you.
And that's all for this week. I'd love to hear what's on your mind. Connect with us on Facebook and Twitter. Send us an email, drpodcast@wamu.org, or leave us a voicemail. That number, 202-854-8851. And go to our website, dianereen.org. Our theme music was composed by Cliff Harden and comes to us courtesy of the Capitol Soundtrack Project here at WAMU. The show is produced by Rebecca Kaufman and Allison Brody. Our engineers this week are Al Reynolds and Douglas Bell. And thanks for listening. I'm Diane Reen.